Historical Inaccuracies, the history podcast.
Oh, steady.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another exciting podcast of Historical Inaccuracies, the history podcast. Woo-hoo. Today, we are going to be discussing US elections and our favourite US presidents as part of the US election special. And we are also, I'm also going to do a wee part about who we think is going to win the election. Who do you think is going to win the election? Not because you like them, but who do you think is going to win and why? So just to kind of recap, we have four friends. Cam, myself, hello. We have The Bexter.
Hello.
We have Maria.
Hello.
And then we have Kelly.
Hello.
And Kelly is our know-nothing today, or as I like to call it, the dunce. So we will be asked, well, Kelly will be asking us questions and we will attempt to answer them. I know for myself I'll probably fucking fail, but anyway, we'll continue with it first. So, to start us off, we have Maria, who will be discussing the election process for presidents in the United States of America. Maria, take it away.
Can I apologise in advance to any American listeners for any mistakes we might make? Because we're not familiar with the process, we're just like researching it and just giving you the gist of it. So, sorry in advance, guys. The election process in the United States begins with the primary elections and the caucuses. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correctly. There are two methods that states use to select a potential presidential nominee. In general, primaries use secret ballots for voting, and caucuses are local gatherings of voters who vote at the end of the meeting for a particular candidate. Then it moves to nominating conventions, during which political parties each select a nominee to unite behind. Now, during a political party convention, each presidential nominee also announces a vice presidential running mate, and the candidates then campaign across the country to explain their views and plans to voters, and they may also participate and debate with candidates from other parties. Now, during the election, Americans go to the polling station to cast their vote for the president, but the tally of those votes, the popular vote, does not determine the winner. What? Instead, presidential elections use the Electoral College. So to win the election, a candidate must receive a majority of electoral votes. In the event no candidate receives a majority, the House of Representatives chooses the president and the Senate chooses the vice president. In other US elections, candidates are indeed directly elected by popular vote, but the president and vice president are not elected directly by citizens, which to me is hugely undemocratic. But anyway, instead, they're chosen by electors through the process called, as I said, the Electoral College. And this is actually, it comes from the actual Constitution. And it was a compromise between a popular vote by citizens and a vote by Congress. May I ask, does anyone have any thoughts on that so far?
I just have like a few things. So I understand that there's the House of Representatives, there's the Senate, there's Congress. Is anyone able to sort of explain a little bit about what each of these things do? Because obviously, to put it in context, like in the British Parliament, there's just, you've got the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And the House of Commons basically makes the sort of like thingy decisions. But whereas I feel like in America, there's loads of different other parties that are involved. And although I hear these words all the time, I'm not 100% sure what they actually mean.
So my understanding is basically you have three kind of systems of government. So you have the legislature, which is the House of Representatives and the Senate, mm-hmm. which essentially is Congress. You then have the executive, which is il presidente.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the judiciary, which is the Supreme Court. Now, each of these forms of government are meant to be a set of checks and balances, keeping one and the other essentially in check to prevent tyranny. So, for example, the legislator basically forms legislation, but also scrutinises legislation as well. Mm-hmm. That also affects the judiciary, the Supreme Court, who uphold the Constitution. But again, they can also, for example, House of Representatives and the Senate push forward legislation, and the judiciary deems it unconstitutional, then essentially they're putting that check upon the House of Representatives. Congress. You then have president who also makes his own legislation known as executive orders, mm-hmm. which is essentially basically him saying, well, actually, I can say this, but then the judiciary again have to see if that executive order is constitutional, with Congress also scrutinising it as well.
If you want to talk about, if you want to kind of very easily compare Congress to the UK, then for our British listeners, then the way I always think about it is, you've got the House of Commons is roughly but not exclusively similar to the House of Representatives, and you've got the House of Lords is roughly similar to but not exactly the same as the Senate.
So does that mean then that the Senate is not elected?
No, the Senate is elected.
They are.
So there's like a
different of the two, but not quite the same.
Yeah.
So everything in America is elected. Like, you pretty much any high form of anything, you cannot be have the job with being elected. So like there's dog catchers,
yes,
in certain parts of America,
sheriffs,
that have to be,
the big one. Yeah,
have to be,
yeah,
elected as well.
I do believe the Supreme Court, though, they're not elected, are they? They are actually
appointed.
Yes, they're appointed by, their initial appointment is by the President, and then it goes to Congress, if I'm correct, who then essentially ratify that nomination.
Yep.
Is that my saying? I believe so, yes.
As far as I'm aware.
They're spot on, and they did have, I think yesterday, was it yesterday or the day before, a very controversial pick for... we've just described, I don't know if you saw the controversy around the new lady.
Oh, was that Amy Coney?
Yes,
Coney
Barrett.
Oh, this is the one that's an ultra conservative and about as far away from Ruth, Queen Ruth, as you could possibly get.
Exactly, which is a shame. But then again, the last 4 years or 2020 is like pretty much out there. But yeah, that was a very good the gist of like what the American system stands for. And in terms of the Electoral College, which like baffles me so much, apparently after you cast your ballot for president, your vote goes to a statewide tally. Now, in 48 states and Washington, D.C., the winner gets all the electoral votes for that state, and Maine and Nebraska sign their electors using a proportional system. A candidate needs the vote of at least 270 electors, which is more than half of them, to win the presidential election. In most cases, a projected winner is announced on election night in November after you vote, but the actual Electoral College vote does take place in mid-December when the electors meet in their states. While the Constitution doesn't require electors to follow their state's popular vote, many states' laws do. And though it's rare, electors have challenged those laws and voted for someone else. But in July 2020, quite recently, the Supreme Court ruled that those state laws are constitutional. So electors must follow their state's popular vote if the state has passed such a law. Now, you know, it's possible to win the Electoral College but lose the popular vote. And this happened in 2016, as we all know, in 2000, and three times in the 1800s. Now, the question that I wanted to ask, how is it possible for the electoral vote to produce a different result than the national popular vote? And at this point, it's critical to remember that the president is not chosen by a national popular vote. It's the Electoral College that determines the winner, not the statistical plurality or majority a candidate may have the national popular vote totals. So they are elected on the basis of the popular vote in each state, the electoral votes. This occurred, as I said, in 2000. I didn't know that. I was only aware of that for President Trump, but apparently George W. Bush received fewer popular votes than Al Gore, but received the majority of electoral votes. And then, of course, we know of 2016, and, you know, Hillary got the votes, but he received the majority of electoral votes.
Do you know where the state that pushed Bush over the winning line was? Florida, which the governor of whom was his brother.
Jeb Bush.
That is crazy.
And just to kind of come back to one of your points, so with regards to Electoral College, and I was reading about this, back in 2016, the US presidential election, Washington State, I believe, gave the majority of their Electoral College votes to the Democrats. However, the Republican votes, one of the Republican Electoral College votes, actually went to Colin Powell.
Really?
Yes, I was quite surprised. They basically had a campaign to say that we don't want Trump as a Republican candidate, so cast your vote for somebody else. So somebody in Washington State, I believe it was, voted on the Republican ticket for Colin Powell.
Well, there you go, Adeline.
Oh, I didn't know that. That was really interesting.
It just won't be me.
One last thing I'm going to say, because again, it baffled me so much, but in general, the way the presidential election goes as a process is this, and this is like typically the cycle that it follows every 4 years. So the spring of the year before the election, the candidates announce their intentions to run. The summer of the year before an election, through spring of the election year, we've got the primary and caucuses that take place, the debates. January to June of election year, states and parties hold primaries and caucuses. And then July to early September, the parties hold the nominating conventions to choose their candidates. September and October, the candidates participate in presidential debates. Famously this year, we had the first one, which was shambles. The second one never happened because Donald Trump got the coronavirus. And then the third one was good because apparently there was a mute capacity was given to the, how do you call it, the person who runs a debate, the facilitator, which was really good, so we can actually hear some like actual views of both candidates. And may I say, the first one was like, we heard shut up man, the other part, like Trump was kind of like going, I felt very unethical. He attacked Biden's son's drug addiction. It was just really, really like low quality. Anyway, then early November, we've got the election day. It's coming up, guys. And then December, we've got the electors who cast their vote in the Electoral College. And then early January of the next calendar year, the Congress counts the electoral votes. And then on January 20th, we've got the, you know, traditionally the inauguration day. And that sums up my part on how the kind of like voting cycle goes in America.
So, Kelly, any questions?
I have actually quite a lot of questions, just because I genuinely don't, like, the system just kind of boggles my mind a bit. So, am I to understand that the reason that there is a two-party system and you just have the Democrats and the Republicans was, from what I've read or what I've heard about, that wasn't actually what George Washington wanted? And am I to understand that the reason that they have that is because it would stop kind of like fascist parties getting into power and stuff like that? Because obviously two-party system is so wildly different from what we have and what other countries have. I was just wondering if that is, I heard that that's the reason why they settled on that format.
See, I don't think it's necessarily a two-party system. Any party can essentially be elected to the House of Representatives or, for example, to the Senate. I think it's just a case, perhaps, I think very kind of similarly in kind of Britain, almost to an extent, whereby you have political parties that have so much financial backing by major businesses that essentially they're able to kind of have like almost like a monopoly over the politics. You've got a similar situation in Britain with kind of the Labour and the kind of Conservatives as well. I do know the Libertarian Party, I think perhaps at some points they've maybe had one, maybe even two House of Representatives congressmen.
Yeah.
But I think it's only ever happened like maybe a couple of times. I'm sure in the state parliaments, but state legislators, because every state's got their own kind of like mini kind of Congress, I'm sure they have a lot more kind of like, there's more participation from other kind of political parties.
You have to kind of consider that America is a very different place from us. So whereas over here, you might say, I tend to vote Conservative or I tend to vote Labour or something. But I mean, unless you're kind of die in the wall, you tend not to bother affiliating yourself. Like, you don't necessarily join a political party.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's maybe a little bit different in Scotland or Wales because you've got Plaid Cymru on the SNP. But America tends to be very, very different. And there is a tendency for them to affiliate themselves with a major party.
I was going to say that in general, like, it's based on like some laws, custom and you know, some party rules, but this is not specifically outlined in the constitution. And there have been, as Cameron said, like the Libertarian Party, but normally the third parties don't receive such support from the public. And it's what goes back to what Becky said, that you're traditionally affiliated with one of the two major ones.
I think a lot of it as well, though, because the Republican Party and Democrats, have been established for so long. I don't think there's been any other political party that's been going for as long as those two parties in America.
No.
Not as far as I'm aware. I think even the Libertarians, I think they were maybe formed in the 60s, I think, I want to say. I'm not entirely sure. But I do know the Democrats have certainly been going for a very, very, very long time. Surely two big ones.
And also, I think possibly a way to think about it is in America, they do everything big. Whereas in this country, I mean, I think we've kind of spoke about this before, but you can travel 20 minutes and the accent has changed twice.
Yeah.
But in America, you can travel 400 miles and you're still in the same state.
That kind of brings me to another question I was going to say, because I'm assuming, again, just kind of trying to understand it, but just kind of comparing it to what, like, I know. So am I right in saying that each state, because from what I understand in America, it is very much you're voting for president. Yeah. More even the party, whereas here it's like the party, it's not a figurehead as such.
Yeah. So in terms of America, they vote specifically for the president. So, you know, like over here in the UK, you do not vote for prime minister.
No,
you vote for a candidate, your local MP, and then the party that has the most MPs elected becomes the ruling party, as it were. It's not the same in America. So in America, because, as you said earlier, the president is separate from Congress, you have to vote for the president. Mm-hmm. So the presidential election is every 4 years.
Correct.
And then the elections to both the representatives and the Senate are every 4 years as well. But it ends up being like every 2 years you have.
Is it not the Senate have like every 5 years, but it's like a third or two thirds of the Senate are up for like election every five years, and I think a House of Representatives, I think you're right, but I'm sure I read somewhere that at one point it was every 2 years at one point.
God, that's horrendous.
Yeah, but like what you could find potentially, Kelly, is this. So like, for example, during Barack Obama's kind of like last years as president, he was the president of America, he was affiliated with the Democratic Party. In Congress, however, Congress was controlled by the Republicans. So you can find, like, for example, if he's trying to put through an executive order being kind of like, I don't know, you know, free marijuana for everybody, and the Republicans are like, no, that's not happening, definitely not, no, yeah. But like, you could find, for example, a situation like that happening, whereby if the president does try to push through an executive order, he could face a hostile Congress, which could inevitably, I believe, can they vote out the executive order? I'm sure they can do
that. Is that not called a veto?
I read a paper at some point in my past life as a student. I read a paper where it said that the whole profile of America, and again, I'm sorry for the listeners, going back to what Becky said, that even the politics with one person voting for the president is so person-centered, because everything is so grandiose that they need, like, you know, a lead figure to lead. And it was kind of comparing like how Greece was defined by Alexander the Great as the one person that made Greece like the kind of center of civilization at the time. And, you know, he occupied the majority of the then known world with his imperialistic tactics. And that's how the American system is profiled. This big leader figure of the free world that kind of like takes over and solves problems in other countries. It was, I found it a very interesting kind of like comparison. And then the other thing is, again, amazing that you've got the two major parties, both Republican and Democratic, essentially the same thing. Democracy, the Greek word, Republic, the Latin, you know, right. And it's just the same thing. It's just like, to me, this is amazing. I'm sorry, I'm a geek.
It's very geared towards the idea of a cult of personality. In a way that many other countries aren't. I mean, look at Trump, look at Obama. They both are excellent examples of this idea of a cult of personality.
Yeah.
Kelly, do you have any more questions?
I will bank them for, like, I think that is my sort of relevant ones for the second.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now we shall move on to the Bexter, who will give us a breakdown of some of the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans.
So I'm just going to take us on a very, very quick exploration of the differences between Democrats and Republicans. So I'm going to try and do this as fast as I can. So apologies in advance if I get any of this wrong in my fervor to get it done as quickly as possible. So in terms of history, the Democrats are originated from anti-federalism sentiment, although it must be said that they have evolved to favour more government legislation as the years have gone by. Republicans, on the other hand, originated from anti-slavery activists and agents of modernity, which, when you consider their current views on things, is very surprising. The philosophy, they tend to be left-leaning and liberal on the Democrat side, and conservative and right-leaning on the Republican side, although obviously there are people that kind of cross the divide, as it were. In terms of geography, Democrats tend to dominate politics in the Pacific Coast, the Northeast, and the Great Lakes region, and Republicans tend to dominate the South and the West regions. Although, obviously, we're talking about vast areas, so it's not just as black and white as that. In terms of demographics, Democrats tend to be associated with young voters, and the Republicans tend to be associated with older voters. In terms of human and social ideas, Democrat views tend to be based on the idea of community and social responsibility, whereas the Republicans tend to be based on individual rights and justice. In terms of abortion, the Constitution, according to the Democrats, should be amended to encourage safe and legal abortion. According to the Republicans, the Constitution should be amended to make abortion illegal. So when it comes to abortions, completely opposing ideas. Regarding same-sex marriage, Democrats tend to applaud same-sex marriage. Republicans tend to condemn same-sex marriage and promote the idea of marriage being between a man and a woman. In terms of social programs, Democrats tend to believe that the government should run social programs such as welfare, unemployment benefits, food stamps, and Medicaid that support people in need, and want to use more tax dollars to fund these programs, whereas although the Republicans acknowledge a need for some or all of these social programs, they favour less funding and tighter control. They also favour supporting private organisations that support people in need. So, in terms of Medicare, Democrats propose lowering the Medicare eligibility age from 65 to 60, and the Republicans tend to impose work requirements and other limitations on Medicaid eligibility.
So that's not bullshit. Personal opinion, I love the NHS, that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
In terms of economic ideas, Democrats tend to favour minimum wages and progressive taxation, whereas Republicans believe that wages should be controlled by the free market, the taxes should be a flat rate that doesn't go up incrementally, and should not be increased. Democrats promise to vigorously implement, enforce, and build on banking regulations enacted to curb the risky practices by financial institutions such as on Wall Street, and will stop dead in its tracks every Republican effort to weaken it. Republicans blamed the Great Recession on the government's own housing policies and not the actions of Wall Street, and called the banking regulations an excuse to establish unprecedented government control over the nation's financial markets. Regarding money in politics, Democrats believe that we need to ease restrictions on corporate and union campaign spending. Republicans believe that we should encourage secrecy and restriction on public corporation campaign spending. So that's a little bit left of centre field. I feel like that's kind of the opposite of what we might feel that they would consider. But anyway, moving on to foreign policy now. Generally speaking, when military involvement may be required, the Democrats favour more targeted strikes and limited use of manpower, while Republicans favour a full military effort to displace regimes that are totalitarian and detrimental to their own people and who are threatening others. Both parties typically agree that sending aid to other countries is a good thing, but they disagree fundamentally on the nature of that aid and who should be receiving it. Both sides have been guilty in the past of placing amendments on this funding to stop money from going to certain groups or certain countries or whatever. In terms of the military budget, Democrats want a decrease in spending on military equipment. Republicans favour an increase in spending on military equipment. And in terms of immigration, Democrats call for fixing the broken immigration system, and Republicans these days are calling on building the wall on the Mexican border to discourage illegal immigration. In terms of climate change, Democrats accept that climate change poses a real threat to the economy, national security, and the health of the world. And Republicans tend to reject findings by the United Nations on climate change. Democrats believe in restricting the drilling of oil or other avenues of fossil fuels to protect the environment, whilst Republicans favour expanded drilling to produce a more energy at a lower cost to consumers. Crime and capital punishment. Democrats are more progressive in their views, believing that crimes do not involve violence, such as selling drugs, should have lighter penalties and rehabilitation. They are also against capital punishment in any form, whereas Republicans generally believe in harsher penalties when someone has committed a crime, including for selling illegal drugs. They also generally favour capital punishment and back a system with many layers to ensure the proper punishment has been meted out. Finally, gun control. Democrats favour or are okay with gun ownership, but advocate stricter controls on firearms such as automatic weapons. Republicans believe fundamentally in the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms, and they oppose any form of gun control.
Can I ask as well, and this is going a little bit into the history without trying to be like too political, the whole gun culture in America just astonishes me. Like, I went there and I just could not believe it. I was just wondering, like, where this whole idea comes from. Is it from, because what I always understood about the gun thing was that in one of the thingies in the Constitution, it says it is our whatever right to bear arms.
So the exact wording of the Second Amendment, which is the one that deals with this, is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Mm-hmm. So it's actually quite vague. But as you say, Kelly, the important thing for many Democrats and sensible-minded people, sorry to our listeners, is that it's yes, it gives you the right, but there is nothing in that says that there shouldn't be, you know, gun controls. Mm-hmm. But I think also it's possibly not a mental thing, but like a cultural thing. You know, like they've got this thing in their amendment that says they're allowed to carry a gun.
You can't buy them from freaking Walmart, like in America.
Yeah.
Exactly. But the idea that it can't be infringed, I think that's the one that Republicans tend to, and some Democrats obviously, tend to get their knickers in a twist about, because it shouldn't be infringed. But I, from a very British point of view, would argue that it's not infringing it, it's just making sure that only people that can actually be sensible with it can get it.
Yeah, I think we have to kind of look at the historical context, because the Constitution of America was ratified in 1791. Mm. So at this particular moment in time, America wasn't the vastly developed nation it is today. It was still very much agricultural, very rural. Mm. And I think perhaps at this particular moment in time, people were mainly using muskets, you know. Kind of like, you get your gun, you fire it, you then got to get the gunpowder back in, then you get your wee kind of long kind of metal rod, you push the ball bearing in, and you bang like that, shoot, and you do that again, basically.
And they couldn't aim for shit.
True, they were incredibly inaccurate. Another kind of point regarding kind of weapons in America is the National Rifle Association. As an organisation, they give so much money to candidates, it's just unbelievable. Mm. And, you know, part of their kind of view is basically, you know, if you are going to become a congressman or whatever it is, you know what I mean, they will support you as long as you vote for kind of like unrestricted gun kind of rights, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's probably part of the reason why gun ownership in America, I think, is so high, is because obviously you have the Constitution, but in addition to this, you also have organisations that are very supportive of it. So, you know, it's a difficult one. And I see why the Americans value this so much, because I think at the same time as well with the Constitution, the idea was like people would bear arms, and if there was to be a dictatorship or a form of tyranny or the reinstitution of the monarchy, wherever it is, you know, the idea of kind of tyranny, then the Americans would be able to rise up and defend themselves and fight for the Republic and fight for the Constitution.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah, that's my bit finished.
Thank you very much. Kelly, questions?
Not really any for this particular session. We've sort of discussed most of the things I was going to say.
Perfect. Okay, so move on to the president's end. Baxter, we're going chronological order. Would you like to go first with Ulysses Grant?
Oh, yes. Okay, right. So, I am going to talk about Ulysses S. Grant, not because he's my favourite president, because I don't actually have a favourite president, but because I think he's a really interesting man. So he has both his supporters and his critics, and I'm hopeful that I will give a reasonable, if not short, account of him. So Ulysses Grant, born the 27th of April 1822, Republican president from 1869 to 1877, and died on the 23rd of July 1885. So I'm going to fast forward. I'm not really going to talk about his early years because, quite frankly, nobody cares. So just to start,
harsh. We Ulysses in the afterlife is like, oh, like I care about my early years.
Well, nobody else here does. So I'm just going to really start at the end of the American Civil War. So on the 9th of April 1865, General Robert E. Lee of the Confederate forces surrendered to Lieutenant General Ulysses Grant in Virginia. And this effectively heralded the end of the American Civil War. So which was, what, 5 years of intense destruction of people, land and general morale. A week after Lee's surrender, President Lincoln was shot dead by John Wilkes Booth at Ford's Theatre. Grant was very hopeful that he would be able to work with newly sworn in President Andrew Johnson, who very quickly promoted Grant to General of the Army in 1866. But unfortunately, this was not to be. Amongst other things, the two men fell out over the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which was passed by the Senate despite Johnson's veto. So the Civil Rights Act defined citizenship and affirmed that all citizens were equally protected by law. So such was Grant's popularity on the back of this. Oh, sorry. To add insult to injury, Congress then passed the Command of the Army Act, which prevented Grant's removal or relocation and forced Johnson to pass executive orders through Grant. So this is effectively like a legal coup. I mean, that's insane. Such was Grant's popularity amongst the people and the politicians that the 1868 Republican National Convention saw delegates unanimously nominate him for the presidency. The Republican platform advocated the immediate, complete and permanent eradication of slavery, equal and civil political rights to all, and African-American enfranchisement, while the Democrats and their nominee Horatio Seymour, which is an excellent name, by the way, focused on ending post-Civil War Reconstruction and returning control of the South to the white Democrats and the planter class. The race was a really close one, and Grant's 300,000 vote victory over his opponent may have been attributable to newly enfranchised black voters. Now, as a president, Grant has what you might call a bit of a mixed review. So positives first. He stabilised the post-war national economy. He worked for the ratification of the 15th Amendment, which gave citizenship to African Americans. He created the Department of Justice and won passage of the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. He supported amnesty for Confederate leaders. He appointed both African American and Jewish Americans to prominent federal offices. He worked to unite the North and South of America, an example of this being his nomination of James Longstreet, who was a former Confederate general, for the position of Surveyor of Customs of the Port of New Orleans, which is like a ridiculously long job title, but I can dig it. Grant was actually sympathetic to women's rights, including the support of female suffrage, saying he wanted equal rights to all citizens. Obviously, you didn't get it, but, you know, it's nice for him to have at least, you know, acknowledged it. And for the West Wing nerds amongst you, in 1872, Grant created Yellowstone National Park, which was America's first national park. However, things did not always go to plan. So in 1871, he created the first Civil Service Commission. But after initially backing its recommendations, he abandoned his support for the commission when it was faced with congressional stubbornness. The Senate rejected Grant's prized Caribbean Dominican Republic annexation, which he hoped to would allow the building of a canal between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Corruption in federal departments was rampant, and four of Grant's appointed cabinet members resigned under scandal, and hundreds of corrupt Grant appointees were fired. All of Grant's executive departments were investigated by Congress at some point during his tenure. And more scandal followed in 1875 when the Treasury Secretary, who was Benjamin Bristow, exposed the operation of the Whiskey Ring, which had the aid of high-placed officials in defrauding the government of whiskey tax revenues. Bastards. Following a serious investigation, federal marshals raided 32 installations nationwide and arrested 350 men, including the president's private secretary, Orville Babcock. 176 indictments were obtained and led to 110 convictions and $3,150,000 returned in fines to the Treasury. So it's a hell of a lot of money. And the final point that I want to kind of talk about here is the inexpertly, or some might say craply, handled panic of 1873 plunged the nation into a severe economic depression, which effectively handed the Democrats the House majority in the next election. But not ideal. But I want to focus on President Grant's views on three things, which are obviously very, very important. And these are the views on the rights of specific groups within the American diaspora. So slavery and the rights of African Americans, the rights of Jewish people, and the rights of Native Americans. So I think these are really good examples of how some things he did were really good, and other things he did, you just sit here and think, why the fuck? So to begin with slavery and the rights of African Americans, to start with, it's worth noting that Grant's views on the rights of African Americans hardened over the course of his life. Very frustratingly and, you know, sadly, in 1858, Grant acquired Bunny is a slave from his father-in-law, and the slave was a 35-year-old man called William Jones. Now, at this point, although Grant wasn't an abolitionist, he wasn't considered, and I use the term very grudgingly, slavery man. Mm-hmm. He could not bring himself to force a slave to do work. In March 1859, Grant freed Bunny is William by a manumission deed. So basically, he charged William to be free, effectively. By 1863, however, so what, 4 years later, Grant fully sympathised with the radical Republicans' aggressive prosecution of the war and their demands for the emancipation of the slaves. Were you wanting to say something there?
Yes, I've got a really interesting fact about his wife, Julie.
She was a Democrat.
She was. The only way she was a Democrat is she herself had four slaves.
I didn't know that, though.
She had four slaves that were given to her by her father, Grant's father-in-law. Mm-hmm. And I believe that they were freed with the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. She was from Missouri, if I'm mm-hmm. correct. And from what I kind of gathered, in fact, along with Andrew Johnson as well, I think he was in the same state, but I think they were both originally from Missouri. Well, he was military governor of Missouri, and he still had slaves as well, even during the Civil War.
Bloody upsetting. Mm-hmm. Absolutely disgraceful. So Reconstruction, which is ending the remnants of the Confederate secession and abolishing slavery, was a priority during Grant's presidency. In his inaugural address, Grant called for the passing of the 15th Amendment, which, as we discussed, prohibited the federal government and each state from denying a citizen the right to vote based on that citizen's race, colour, or previous condition of servitude. In March 1869, within 2 months of beginning his presidency, Grant signed into law equal rights for black people, or African Americans, sorry, to serve on juries and hold office, and he worked with Congress to create the Justice Department to prosecute, amongst others, the Ku Klux Klan. Finally, for this section, in 1870, he signed into law the Naturalization Act that gave foreign-born black people the right to citizenship.
Good honour.
The hand giveth, the hand taketh away, the hand needs a slap round the head. So I want to move on quickly to the rights of Jewish people. So Grant's views on Jewish people appear a little bit more complicated. In 1862, during the Civil War, Grant had issued General Order No. 11, which expelled Jewish people from his military district to try and stop an illicit trade of Southern cotton. I'm not entirely sure how one leads to the other, but it apparently, according to him, did. 3 weeks later, after considerable outrage, President Lincoln countermanded the order. During his presidency, Grant appointed over 50 Jewish people to federal office, including naming Edward Salomon as the territorial governor of Washington. And Salomon was the first Jewish American to be elected to such high office, which is exciting. During both his terms, Grant appeared to be sympathetic to the plight of Jewish people. And in late 1869, he publicly supported a petition against the Russian Tsar Alexander II for expelling 2,000 Jewish families from his kingdom and appointed a Jewish journalist as an American consul to Romania to protect Jewish people from severe oppression. And finally, you'll be glad to know, moving on to the rights of Native Americans. So this one very much has a mixed bag, is a mixed bag. As Grant took his oath of office in 1869, the nation's policy towards Native Americans was a complete mess, with around 250,000 Native Americans being affected by 370 treaties, which is ridiculous. To try and make sense of it all, Grant named Eli Parker, who was a Seneca Native American, to the position of Commissioner of Indian Affairs. Now, Parker was the first Native American to serve in that position. In April 1869, Grant established an unpaid board of Indian commissioners to oversee implementation of his Indian peace policy, but he is. In 1871, Grant ended the sovereign tribal treaty system, which meant that Native Americans became wards of the federal government. But I think that's still in place. I can't say for certain, but in my mind, mm-hmm. it's still that the Native Americans are the wards of the federal government. I don't know. I'll look that up before I upload okay. this. Sadly, however, after some initial successes, Grant's Native American policy began to struggle, beginning with Parker's resignation in 1871. Now, in 1873, Major General Edward Canby was killed during a failed peace conference to end the Modoc War. The Modoc leader, I'm sorry if I get this wrong, Kinpoosh? That one. Was convicted of murder and hung whilst the remaining Modoc tribe was relocated. Grant pocket vetoed a bill in 1874 protecting bison in support of Interior Secretary Delano, who believed, somewhat correctly, that the killing of bison would force Plains Native Americans to abandon their nomadic lifestyle. It was literally a concerted attack on their entire lifestyle. But for me, that is equally, what's equally as bad as that, is that in October 1874, Grant offered the Sioux tribe $6 million for the Black Hills because gold had been discovered. As Chief Red Cloud reluctantly entered negotiations, are the Sioux chiefs ready for war? By the end of 1875, Grant agreed not to keep miners away from the Black Hills and to force hostile Native Americans onto the Sioux reservation. By 1876, the Great Sioux War came as a direct result of the US government's actions and desire for land. And perhaps the most famous battle that I think probably we've all heard of is that of Little Bighorn, where warriors led by Crazy Horse killed General Custer and his men. And what I find really telling is Grant castigated Custer in the press, saying, "I regard Custer's massacre as a sacrifice of the troops brought on by Custer himself that was wholly unnecessary." Sadly for the Sioux peoples, in September and October 1876, Grant convinced the tribes of the Black Hills to relinquish the Black Hills, with Congress ratifying the agreement 3 days before Grant left office in 1877. All in all, Grant had bad points as well as good, and I don't think that we could say he's infallible. I wonder if perhaps it would be fair to maybe give him a 6 out of 10 and acknowledge that whilst in some ways he was a good president, in others he was a bit of an ass.
Wholeheartedly agree. I think the thing about Custer is very interesting, and that he was just so far up his arse and thought that he would be able to, to essentially fight these people who, essentially, the land had been taken away from them. They weren't going to give it up.
What does that mean?
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
But yeah, that's my ranting over. Kelly, any questions?
No.
Any thoughts on Grant?
I think it's you can't really. I think any president or any person really from that time is never going to be like. You can't really hold them up and say he's a great guy, she's a great gal, when they're products of their time. they're going to be very problematic, probably in some aspect more than others. But yeah, I think that's a fair, a 6 out of 10 is a fair, like, acknowledge what they've done, but then also acknowledge that some of it was not great.
Okie dokie. So if it's okay with you, ladies, I'll move on to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
And the New Deal.
And the New Deal, yes, indeed. I will be discussing the New Deal. Thank you very much. So one of my favourite presidents is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was born on the 30th of January, 1882, in the town of Hyde Park in the state of New York. He began his political career, in 1910, with him becoming a New York State Senator until 1913. Between 1913 and 1919, he became the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And in 1920, he was nominated Vice President with James M. Cox running for President on the Democratic ticket.
Yeah, Cox.
Cox. After the election, he returned to New York City and practiced law. However, in 1921, he fell ill and was diagnosed with polio. However, it is thought that his symptoms related more to Julian Bear syndrome. In 1925, he was appointed to the Taconic State Park Commission and was chosen as chairman, and he continued in this post until 1928. FDR was then convinced to run for governor of the state of New York in 1928 and won that election. And in 1932, Roosevelt was elected president, winning against Herbert Hoover, and he would win another three elections in 1936, 1940 and 1944. On the 12th of April 1945, Roosevelt would die of intracerebral hemorrhage. So, yes, I know, very sad. Just a kind of little fact here. Becky and I were actually discussing this, how many terms the president can have now. It is two now. He was the only, and I believe last president, to have more than two terms. So I thought it was quite interesting. So I just thought I'd kind of throw that in there. So, why do I like Roosevelt? So, in June of 1941, Roosevelt issued the Executive Order 8802, which created the Fair Employment Practice Committee, or FEPC. It was the most important federal move in support of the rights of African Americans between Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The president's order stated the federal government would not hire any person based on their race, colour, creed, or national origin. Was seen as rather progressive for the time. However, fortunately, FDR did little to desegregate the military, which continued. The Federal Emergency Relief Administration was established in 1933, again by Roosevelt, which gave grants to states, including construction projects for professionals and the production of consumer goods. In addition to this, it also included the redistribution of food, which included direct distribution, food stamps, and school lunches, the media and the poor, in an effort to also combat the depression. In 1935, the Social Security Act was enacted and the programme was expanded to provide payments to widows and dependents of Social Security recipients. Some job categories, however, were not covered by the Act, which included workers in agricultural labour, domestic service, government employees, including many teachers, nurses, hospital employees, librarians and social workers. The programme was funded through a newly established payroll tax, which later became known as the Federal Insurers Contributions Act. And Social Security taxes would be collected from employers by the states, with employers and employees contributing equally to the tax. In addition to creating the programme, the Social Security Act also established a state-administered unemployment insurance system and the age-dependent children, which provided aid to families headed by single mothers. Between 1936 and 1937, the Flint sit-down strike occurred between General Motors and the United Automobile Workers. FDR refused to intervene, and an order was made by the governor from Michigan, the National Guard, to protect the strike workers from the police and strike breakers. This led to the car industry in America becoming heavily unionized and allowed workers' rights from working in these industries. Now, for one of the main things that I think really kind of, I think, me personally, puts FDR really up there, was the Lend-Lease Policy, which was formally titled An Act to Promote the Defence of the United States, which allowed Allied states, such as the USSR, the UK and France during the Second World War, provisions in terms of food, oil and materials. So the food in particular was essential to the war effort of the Soviet Union, as over 40% of the farms used to produce food were lost to the Nazis in the early stages of the war. And to quote Nikita Khrushchev, "I would like to express my candid opinion about Stalin's views on whether the Red Army and the Soviet Union could have coped with Nazi Germany and survived the war without aid from the United States and Britain. First, I would like to tell about some of the remarks Stalin made and repeated several times when we were discussing freely, Bundes, among ourselves. He stated bluntly that if the United States had not helped us, we would not have won the war. On a personal note, during the Battle for Normandy, Polish 1st Armoured Division, Jedna Dywizja Pancerna, fought at the Battle of Hill 262. Due to the Lend-Lease Agreement, Polish soldiers were able to utilise American German tanks, which led to their victory and the defeat of the Germans. On August the 20th, the Germans, being surrounded, attempted to fight their way through and essentially were able to escape and circumvent by the Poles. And this essentially maintained Hill 262, and the Polish soldiers were eventually relieved by the Canadian Grenadier Guards. Now, due to this battle, and again the provisions provided by the Americans to the soldiers, this led to the closure of the, I believe it's Falaise, I don't know how to say that in French, pocket, which essentially led to the Falaise. Falaise pocket, yeah, I'm going to go for that. So this subsequently led to the closure of the Falaise pocket, sorry if I butchered it, leading to the capture of between 40 to 50,000 German soldiers, which led the way for the Allies to eventually liberate Paris. So, FDR, like, for example, Ulysses, did have detractions. For example, Executive Order 9066. This was a mass internment of Japanese civilians during the war, in which roughly 120,000 Japanese expatriates and American citizens of Japanese ancestry were to be confined in internment camps. This was in part heavily motivated by the fear of Japanese Americans following the 7th of December 1941 and the Pearl Harbor attack. Roosevelt, he also condemned lynching as murder. However, he did not support the Republican proposal to make it a federal crime, although his wife Eleanor did so. Roosevelt told an advocate, "If I come out for the anti-lynching bill now, they, Southern Democratic senators, will block every bill I ask Congress to pass to keep America from collapsing. I just can't take that risk." And something that I also found quite interesting was after 1936, the Berlin Olympics, only the white athletes were invited to see and meet Roosevelt. No such invitation was made to the African-American athlete, Jesse Owens, who had won 4 gold medals. So, overall, I would give FDR probably about I'll be generous. I'll give him 7 out of 10. I think he did do a lot of work in terms of helping poor and working class people in America. I think the Lend-Lease program was really kind of crucial to the war effort, particularly for the Soviet Union, also for Britain as well, and France. So, you know, he did do a lot of good. He could have done probably a lot more. But overall, I think he was okay. Any questions, Kelly?
Something as well as with you sort of mentioning like the good or the bad things about FDR that's quite interesting is I was wondering if you had anything more about his involvement in the design of the atomic bomb.
So, Kelly, did you know that the nuclear development program started in Britain?
See, I didn't know any of that. I just thought that the atomic bomb was developed by the Americans.
I'll not go too much into it, because at some point I assume we're going to do a World War II pod, and I really don't want to like kind of give the game away too soon. But effectively, it was started in, I believe it was Oxford University.
I think so as well.
Yeah, Oxford University. It was something that was started within the British government, and then eventually the high and mighty over here realised that we kind of needed the not necessarily the brains of the Americans, but the money of the Americans. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as we told the Americans kind of went, no. So we ended up having to, all of our scientists ended up moving over to America and got stuck in a back room in the middle of Texas or something like that. And the Americans pretty much took it on from there. So in terms of FDR's, I think he only really became involved when the Americans became involved. I don't think he was involved initially. I think that was us.
As far as I'm aware, that's correct. I think he would have probably had oversight, perhaps, of the actual production of it. But in terms of actually being involved, I'll be honest, I'm not entirely sure. I'm assuming it would have been fed reports, etc., about the development of it. It's interesting to note, though, that I believe it was actually Harry Truman that was the president at the time, because he essentially took over FDR.
Right, so FDR wouldn't have been the one to give the orders to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
No, that was Harry Truman.
Okay.
Truman didn't know anything about it, so when FDR was, when it all moved over to America and the Americans kind of basically took control, Truman and FDR, I don't know whether it was that they didn't get on, or that FDR just didn't trust many people, and he didn't want Truman to be involved. Obviously, when FDR died and Truman took over, Truman had absolutely no idea about this kind of thing, and he really struggled with it. And there's quite a few very interesting articles and documentaries about how Truman really did not want to make this decision. And ultimately, yes, he made the decision, but he really didn't want anything to do with it, and he really hated the idea of it. And in a way, I'm kind of glad that it wasn't us that made the decision, because I think we've got more than enough to apologise about in history.
What's actually really interesting to note, Kelly, as well, is during the Korean War, General Douglas MacArthur himself actually wanted to drop nuclear bombs on the North Koreans in order to end the war. However, I believe there was a bit of a political spat between him and Truman. I think eventually Truman said, no, that's not going to happen. Ultimately, the decision lies with me as the executive. You are the army. I'll make that decision. It seems a bit odd. You would expect maybe the army to make that decision. But ultimately, he didn't give MacArthur the use of the nuclear weapons. So I think it must have been a horrible decision for him to make. But ultimately, it was Truman that made it, not FDR. But I do believe that FDR would have had oversight of the production, not the of the weapons.
Thank you. That was all from me.
Nothing else at all.
No.
Thank you. So, Maria, on to yourself, and I believe you're going to be discussing Mr. Barack Obama.
I know that's a very obvious choice, and of course there has been critique over his presidency, which lasted from 20th January 2019 to 20th January 2017. However, there have been some tremendous like landmarks in his during his presidency, and I'm going to briefly speak about some of those and then briefly mention a few others that I think need to be mentioned. So without further ado. First of all, we've got January 20th, 2009, Obama's first inauguration, and that's a landmark in its own because he was inaugurated as the nation's 44th and first African-American president, and an estimated 1.8 million people attended his first inauguration. And if you remember, there was controversy again over the pictures over like Trump's inauguration and Obama's, and the second ones were the Trump ones were fabricated, of course. But anyway. March 23, 2010, Obamacare becomes the law. So Obama used apparently 20, I don't know if this is true, 22 pence to sign the healthcare overhaul, known as the Affordable Care Act, into law on March 23, 2010, marking the dawn of a new day for the American healthcare system and the beginning the Republicans' efforts to undo it. So, and that was after five presidents over a century failed to create universal universal health insurance. It was supposed to cover 32 million uninsured Americans beginning in 2014, and did mandate a suite of experimental measures to cut healthcare cost growth, the number one cause of America's long-term fiscal problem. Then in May 2nd, 2011, another landmark day, I think, for the planet, Osama bin Laden was killed. An early morning raid in Pakistan by U.S. special forces delivered the end of a year's long effort to bring down the Al-Qaeda leader behind the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. That's another podcast for us, guys. He also ended the war in Iraq, and he ordered all of the U.S. military forces out of the country, and the last troops at the time left, I think, on December 18th, 2011. And of course, another landmark highlight was that in December 12, 2015, the Paris Climate Deal was reached. The Paris Climate Agreement was adopted on December 12th, and it was a monumental multinational agreement that set out to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and roll back damage done to the environment. And then he further passed the Wall Street Reform, and he signed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act in 2010 to re-regulate the financial sector after its practices caused the Great Recession. The new law at the time tightened capital requirements of large banks and other financial institutions and required derivatives to be sold on clearinghouses and exchanges mandated that large banks provided living wills to avoid chaotic bankruptcies, and limited their ability to trade with customers' money for their own profit. These are, for me, at least, some of the highlights that give you a bit more detail on. But then there's some others that I think need to be mentioned, and I'm going to be quite quick here. He began the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan. He signed the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, allowing as many as 5 million people living in the US legally to avoid deportation and receive work permits. He dropped the veteran homeless rate by 50%. He improved school nutrition with the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. And that's, I mean, with all the, in the UK, if you follow the current news, you'll see that we have a similar debate going on in our political landscape, past few weeks. Anywho, no comment. He repealed the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He signed the Hate Crimes Prevention Act, making it a federal crime to assault anyone based on sexual or gender identification. He signed the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act to combat pay discrimination against women. He nominated Sonia Sotomayor, I think is how it's pronounced, to the Supreme Court, making her the first Hispanic ever to serve as a justice assistant in the Supreme Court. He won the Nobel Prize, the Peace Prize, in 2009 for his extraordinary effort to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between peoples. He launched My Brother's Keeper, a White House initiative designed to help young minorities achieve their full potential. He expanded embryonic stem cell research, leading to groundbreaking work in areas including spinal injury treatment and cancer. And finally, the most important of them all, he was the husband of Michelle, and their relationship, did I say more? Goals. And that concludes my wee section on Obama. Love.
Thank you very much, Maria. Kelly, do you have any questions?
I don't really have questions per se, but I did have one thing, and the only reason I'm saying it is because it recently popped up in a YouTube video that I was watching, a YouTube talking about it, in terms of some aspects of the Obama administration that weren't so great. There was one thing that got passed which I believe was called the FATCA, which was the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, which was particularly harmful for American expats. So essentially, I'm pretty sure there was another act that went along with it. But essentially, for people that didn't know, and I didn't know this until 2 days ago when I watched the YouTube video, but it is very, very hard to leave America and be an American citizen outside of America. So from what I understand, essentially, the USA is one of only two countries in the world that tax based on both citizenship and as well as residence. So basically, if you're an American citizen and you move abroad, you will still get taxed by the IRS, despite, even if you don't live there and you've not lived there for however many years, because they tax you based on your citizenship. And yeah, so basically, this act that was passed by the Obama administration essentially made it so, and this is quite disturbing just for general world citizens as well, they basically made it so that, because obviously American expats have this duty that they have to be taxed on top of the tax rate that they're paying in the country that they're residing in, they have to pay the tax to the IRS as well, the American Tax Service. But essentially what this act meant was that financial institutions, so you're talking about your banks, so like banks in the UK, banks in Europe, banks anywhere, basically have to give the USA permission to search their records to check that their customers are not American, because if they are American, they will get taxed on top of their earnings.
I'm not sure if what you're describing like is the same situation as me, but I think this is like for every, maybe I'm getting this wrong, but I think this is for every or most countries where like me as a Greek citizen living in the UK, if I have any earnings or anything, like I need to declare to the UK, because that's my primary residence and income, I need to declare if I have, like, you know, any rent that comes, you know, to me, or any kind of income that comes in a different country, then the primary country, which is the UK, sort of like goes over the two different incomes, and then they tax me from the one country, but on behalf of both, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, well, in America, you have to pay the two rates, and then also if you... even if you become a citizen, you still have to pay, from what I could understand from this YouTube video. Yeah. So basically they get taxed. So basically they would pay, say if you paid 40% tax in the UK, like say you were an American living in the UK and you got citizenship and you paid 40% tax, because you still get taxed in America based on your citizenship, not on your residency, they would still tax you on top of that. So basically it's very, very hard from what I can understand. And maybe I've misinterpreted this wrong, but from this YouTube video that I was watching, it is very hard for them to basically leave, because they will consistently get taxed based on the fact that they're American. And by proxy, if they were to marry a non-American, that person gets taxed as well, because of to do with like American to do with American tax laws, and it's basically been made worse because of this FATCA thing that was passed. But that basically means that the USA is able to see all our bank accounts, just to check that we're not American. So basically the USA can go to, like, I don't know, like Lloyd's or whatever, and be like, we want to see all of your customers who were born in America, because we have a right to tax them. And like, they will look, so they can look into your records. This is what this act means, even though it applies in America, it applies throughout the world as well. But it basically gives the US government permission to access financial institutions' records to check to see who is American and who is owed them tax, basically.
So, Kaz, come in here for a second, Kelly. So if they're able to access like financial records for banks from the UK and stuff like that, right, does that mean that they're able to see my gold membership subscription to Pornhub?
Oh, yes. Well, they might have a wee piece of cam.
Well, I'm cancelling my subscription today anyway, as soon as I get back home. I mean, and that was a joke. I don't actually subscribe to anything from fucking like that. Back to your point, though, about like taxation stuff like that. I think in terms of your situation, Maria, Britain does have like a double taxation agreement with Greece. So if you're taxed in Greece, then you shouldn't be liable for tax, like, for example, in the UK.
Mm.
America, though, I think Poland has a similar kind of situation, because I'm sure Anna still has to pay something in order for
But it won't be the same rate. It'll be a reduced rate, whereas in America you have to pay the full for both. Yeah.
But Anna has to pay something to the Polish government. So if she ever goes back to Poland, then she's able to use their version of the NHS and vote. But she has to pay like a special kind of tax.
But I'm assuming if you become a citizen, then I don't know, obviously, because I've never done it. But I'm assuming if you were to become a citizen of somewhere, then you would only pay tax to the country of which you are a citizen after that point, unless you're American.
Because
unfortunately, not
of residency. So if you are a resident in the UK, then you pay tax to HMRC. Yeah. If you are a British citizen, for example, let's say living in, I don't know, like Spain, if you were to get British income, then you can be taxed by Spanish authorities, or you can still fill in a self-assessment form and be taxed by British authorities. But exactly. Yeah, for the tax that you've taken, that's been taken off by the British authorities to the Spanish tax authorities. Taxation. It's a fucking minefield.
Yes, it is. Sorry for bringing it up. It was just something I saw recently, and I thought that was quite bad. I was like, I would not want to be an American expat. But
no,
yeah.
No.
So, any further questions, Kelly?
No, that is all.
Okay. Well, okay. Maria, thank you very much. Now on to the quiz. Quiz first, and then we will win the election. So, first question: who was the last president to own slaves?
Was it my guy?
Ulysses S. Grant.
Well done, Kelly. So, as Becky discussed, next question. In which state was FDR born?
Oh,
any other takers?
Missouri?
Alabama?
New York State.
Oh,
I do like Alabama. Yo, Alabama!
Is Alabama state?
So, sorry?
Is Alabama state?
Yeah, it's a state, yeah. Is it, you know, they marry their cousins, you know, that kind of shit.
Sister wives,
yeah, jokes. Okie dokie. Ulysses S. Grant founded which national park?
Oh, Yellowstone.
Oh, Fester gets that one. Who was the first president, US president, to be impeached?
Johnson. Andrew Johnson.
Well done, Fester.
Yes.
So, Andrew Johnson was impeached in March of 1868 when the House voted to convict him. However, the vote failed as it required 36 senators to vote aye and only 35 did. He did not win the Democratic presidential nomination in 1868 and returned home to Tennessee, not Missouri as I thought it was, for Tennessee. Next question. Barack Obama was the senator for which state?
Illinois.
Well done, Baxter. Right, okay. You're on fire today.
Oh no, I forgot the name of the bloke I did an entire 10-minute segment on.
Last one. Who was the first US president to be assassinated?
Lincoln, that's the obvious.
Kelly, Baxter, point each.
Oh.
You're right. Abraham Lincoln was the first president assassinated on the 15th of April 1865 by a man called John Wilkes Booth Trump at Ford Theatre. So yes, Bex with 4, Kelly 2, and Maria gets a love heart because we love her. So who will win the US election? So it really is a choice between essentially a tangled turd, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden, who I genuinely believe is that fucking senile, that I just see him, you know, walking into a fucking cupboard in the White House once he's elected and dying. Essentially, because he won't know where the fuck he is. You know what's going to happen. So essentially, Maria, we'll start with you, my darling. Who do you think will win, Trump or Biden?
I'm so afraid that Trump will win again, because okay. I'm not convinced by Biden's. I think Biden's going to be a better president, but I'm not convinced by his public persona. Trump is a very populist politician, and I think that works with the American people, I'm really sorry to say. And I'm just hoping it won't happen, but I'm afraid it's going to be Trump again.
Okay, Maria says Trump. Kelly?
I have to say I'm a bit pessimistic as well. I don't want it to be, but I've got a horrible gut feeling that he might get re-elected. Like, I think there's a large, if the sort of last election and this one has shown anything, is that there is a large part of America that we don't see in the media, and they're all the ones who are voting him in. And I think if you were to take it at face value from like the media and from seeing things, it seems like Joe Biden's in a good position, but I'm just worried about that sort of silent majority that might that might end up prevailing again. So as much as I want to be hopeful, like pessimistically, part of me is thinking that it might get re-elected. As much as I don't want to say that, but
okay. So you think he'll be the Trump bummer?
Not to be a total downer, but I think I've got a horrible feeling that it might be. Yeah. Just in 2020 is going this way anyway, like I feel like
I think there is light at the end of the tunnel, but okay, Baxter, evaluation.
I hope I'm wrong. I should just put that in there. I hope I'm wrong, but yeah.
I am gonna say Trump as well. But not necessarily for anything that he's gonna do, but more because If it's a country of what, 360 million people, something like that. It's over 300 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And the best two people that they can come up with is either Trump or Biden, right?
Mm.
Now, I'm not going to lie to you, but, you know, as a foreign observer looking in, Biden doesn't really fill me with excitement. He doesn't make me jump up and down and go, oh my God, he's amazing and he's wonderful and now this is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, looking from that point of view, if you've got the undecided voters, I'm not sure that Biden is enough.
It goes back to what you said about the cult of personality.
Yes. Mm. Biden doesn't have that cult of personality that Trump does. The only reason that, in my opinion, the only reason that Biden has any sort of cult of personality at all is as a reaction to Trump. And if something is a reaction to something as opposed to something in its own right, I'm not sure that that's going to get the undecided voters out. I really don't.
And he might get some votes for Kamala Harris, who was exceptional on the debate, I think.
Mm. Possibly, yes. But Kamala Harris, in terms of actual who's going to be in the White House, it's not going to be her until Biden snuffs it. So I just, I think I'm going to say Trump purely on the idea that I don't think Biden is enough.
I think surely there's something wrong with the system if the two main candidates for the leaders of, as they like to say, the free world, are like men in their 70s. Like they're literally like their grandparents' age. Like why is it not younger people? Why are the young people not being, why are younger people not representing the country? Why is it all little old men? Yeah.
I mean, to be fair though, you know, the only other kind of like nominee or potential nominee that I ever kind of really heard of was Kanye West. And with all due respect to him, he is a fucking knob.
Oh, yeah, that's very respectful, eh?
Fucking, that's all I can say, you know. Like, you know, I'm the greatest rapper out there. No, you're not, you're that fucking tit.
So, Cam, tell us who you think is going to win.
I genuinely think it will be Biden, and it's not just down to vote, but I do think a lot has happened since the start of 2020. And I do think, not just on a personal level, but I do think that due to the complete fuck ups that have happened with Trump, you know, I mean, where do we even start, to be quite frank, you know what I mean? The whole issue with him going to that church and standing with the Bible and people getting pushed out the side and stuff like that. Because, I mean, I don't pretend to be a decent Christian in any fucking sense of the word. But I do know it's not a very Christian thing to be pushing people out the way just so you can hold the fucking Bible and be kind of like, you know, yeah, look at me, I'm anti-abortion. So I do think, and I think Biden, I think people probably see him as a safe pair of hands, a return to kind of like US normal relations, as opposed to Trump, who's just basically ripped up essentially a lot, I think a lot of good kind of groundwork in terms of, you know, US relations with Iran. I mean, that's one of them. And we're saying about the Paris Climate Accord, you know, other things as well. So I do think it'll be Biden. But as I said, I do think though, like he will get locked in a closet somewhere. Nobody will notice him. He will pass away, and Kamala Harris will be like, "Yes, I am now the president."
Yes.
Well, in about a week, one of us is gonna, at least one of us is gonna look really stupid.
Yeah. We'll just have to wait and see, won't we? But it will be interesting to see who wins, regardless. But yeah, any other thoughts, ladies?
No, that was really interesting. And yes. I hope that our American listeners aren't too offended by us non-Americans talking about American things.
So next week's podcast is going to be on LGBT history. So again, another exciting one as well. So just to say thank you very much, listeners. If you have subscribed and listen, please, please, please share this with your friends, family, partners, fucking dogs, if you know, I mean, fucking whatever. Just anybody, genuinely. And we do have a Twitter page. So it is
at HIAH podcast. Please give us a follow, and actually, if you can, share your thoughts on any episodes you want there, and we'll try and get back to you. No abuse, though. Thank you.
So it's goodbye from me, Cam. Goodbye. Goodbye from the Bexter.
Bye.
Bye from Kelly.
Bye.
And goodbye from Maria.
Bye-bye.
Listeners, thank you very much for listening to the podcast. Just a cheeky wee update from last week in terms of our US election special. I'm pleased to announce that we actually do have a winner. Ladies, we do have a winner. If you've been watching the news, yes, it's true. It's true. Heard it here first. I would like to say a massive congratulations to Mr. Kanye West. Yes, thank you. The one, the only, the Messiah. Songbird of our generation.
Jesus.
Yeah, you know, he's like, you know, Jesus, Buddha, Vishnu, and, you know, Jason Donovan all rolled into one. You know what I mean? He's just a fucking hero. So Kanye, we love you over here. Actually, I'm fucking around, obviously. We don't know who's won. But by what I can see, it could potentially be Biden. Okay, Michigan, Wisconsin, pull the finger out. Georgia. South Carolina, I think it is. Fuck you. But what I actually,
and Florida.
And Florida.
Yeah, well, Florida's a fucking dump, so anyway.
Apologies to all of our listeners from Florida.
Yes. But more importantly than the US election, Arizona, New Jersey, and South Dakota, all look to have voted to legalize marijuana for personal use.
Nice, gone then.
Yeah. Kelly, you seem quite disappointed.
I just said yes, go on then.
Go on then. I'm taking this. If I win the lottery, we are all going to South Dakota. Was it North Dakota? South Dakota. We're going to both Dakotas anyway. But and we're not going to New Jersey because I've heard that's a bit of a dump as well. I'm sorry, actually, our American listeners. I'm just kind of, it's not. Anyway, sorry.
So there you go. Basically, what that was there is Cam's going to pay for us to go to the States and get absolutely looted on various recreational drugs.
Well, one singular recreational drug.
Oh, if you win the lottery, you're bloody taking us out somewhere nice. Thank you very much.
Well, I won't buy cocaine. That's too expensive. Like £50 a gram nowadays.
I mean, to be fair, that is a long way to go when you can just go to Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Amsterdam's like an hour and a half on the plane.
Why do you have to be such a fucking killjoy? I've been insulted. She's taking the piss out of me for going to Tesco. Well, maybe that was you, Maria. I can't remember now. It was about 5 minutes ago. And then now I want to take you all away and wine and dine you and be like history podcast. Now I'm getting slated for saying, let's go to America. Oh, no, we should go to Amsterdam.
No, I
want to
go to America because I want to see an ice hockey match.
An ice hockey match?
Yeah. I want to see an NBA match.
NBA, okay. Kelly, what about you? What would you like to see in America?
Not get shot.
I think that's a reasonable
request.
Yeah. Anything as long as I don't get shot. I'm happy with that.
Cirque du Soleil.
Cirque du Soleil, yeah.
New York, Broadway.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Right, okay. So we've got our list started.
American soccer, or I should say, well, you know, like, you know, not American football, but like football in America. Like Major League is what they call it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we can maybe see that.
Well, I'll tell you what, you go with Jack and we'll do anything but that.
Okay, then that's fine. Sounds good.